This is Steve Smith at WCG Patient Radio. WCG is a company focused on the ethical, safe, and efficient conduct of clinical trials for the benefit of patients with unmet medical needs. We're speaking today with Tasha Lee, Vice President, Social and Clinical Research and Development at the National Minority Quality Forum. She's here to speak to us today about reducing health disparities and diversity and inclusion in clinical research and health, and about a specialty of hers, sickle cell disease. Tasha has a PhD in integrative biology with a concentration on neuroscience from Florida Atlantic University, a master's of public health and epidemiology from the George Washington University, and a bachelor's in biology from Florida A&M University. Dr. Lee is an adjunct assistant professor at George Washington School of Medicine, George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences, and she's the recipient of numerous awards, including the 2018 National Minority Quality Forum's 40 Under 40 Leaders in Minority Health Award and the Congressional Black Caucus's Health Brain Trust Staff Leadership Award in recognition of efforts to end health disparities and the Distinguished Alumni Award from Florida Atlantic University. At the National Minority Quality Forum, Tasha Lee is responsible for the oversight and implementation of research projects and programs focused on reducing patient risk and health disparities. Prior to that, she was Senior Manager of Partnership Engagement of the Sickle Cell Disease Clinical Trials Network at the American Society for Hematology Research Collaborative, where she was tasked with the development of a patient engagement strategy and clinical trials network to change the culture and the conduct of clinical research for this devastating disease. On the global front, she was co-lead on the development of a newborn screening and early interventions consortia for the sickle cell disease itself in sub-Saharan Africa. She was working for the development and execution of activities related to the American Society for Hematology's call to action on sickle cell disease, as well as the Sickle Cell Disease Coalition, with lots of activity on Capitol Hill, legislative and regulatory change activities. Latasha is here to spend some time with us. We're most grateful for that. Hello, Tasha.
Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for the invitation to join you today.
Your education and background makes you an ideal person to take the lead on a number of fronts in which the National Minority Quality Forum focuses its advocacy. And prior to this, you did all that work I just talked about in sickle cell disease. I think your experiences and insights are helpful to those seeking to improve things for people underserved by the healthcare system in general and clinical trials, underserved in clinical trials, whether that's in rare diseases or sickle cell or many other diseases where people simply aren't included. Tell us about your path and how it is that you have come to be an expert in sickle cell, have worked with issues that bring disproportionate impact onto African Americans and other minorities here in the United States, and the work you've done in the patient advocacy arena. How did you start and get to be where you are?
Well, Steve, that's a really hard question, so I'll give you the short answer. I am really passionate about sickle cell disease because sickle cell trait and disease are in my family. I have a roughly 30-year-old cousin with disease and a newborn baby cousin who was diagnosed earlier this year, and several family members with sickle cell trait who've had a number of complications because it's not simply a benign disease. I've always been involved in advocacy efforts from a young child and always felt the need to help others because that's how you pay it forward. I got involved really in sickle cell disease, ironically, not through education or studying in grad school or even undergrad. I was working on Capitol Hill. I was working for a member of Congress and happened upon a piece of legislation that I really thought should be addressed, from a policy standpoint, and met my former employer, the American Society of Hematology, and just really worked hard to bring more attention to this devastating disease who, you know, impacts about 100,000 individuals in the U.S., but globally millions. I've also been involved in advocacy on the cancer front and lupus and other diseases that really do have disproportionate impacts on African American and brown and black lives. My route to the NMQF has been an interesting one. Interestingly, while I spent 2 years as a Congressional Black Caucus Fellow, I interacted with the National Minority Equality Forum through the Congressional Black Caucus's Health Brain Trust work with them. They are a really established partner in the disparities field and really brought me up to speed on some of the issues facing minority communities across the nation. And in terms of sickle cell disease, I really learned a lot by my experience in my past role at ASH. Really learned from amazing members who are hematologists and researchers who are really dedicated and passionate to this disease. I love reading, and so honestly, I've learned a lot from books, but also from the personal experiences of individuals impacted with sickle cell disease.
You're in a leadership role now at the National Minority Equality Forum. Tell us about what is the National Minority Equality Forum? What's its mission, and what does this role entail?
Great. So the National Minority Equality Forum is a nonprofit 501c3 Washington, D.C.-based healthcare research as well as education organization. Our CEO, Dr. Gary Puckern, often states we are a patient organization at our heart, but we're not in that, you know, formal patient capacity building area. But we really focus on reducing patient risk by ensuring optimal care. Interestingly, I did not know this until I came to NMQF about a month and a half ago, that the organization was founded in the 90s really to address the critical need of strengthening the national and local efforts around minority health. In fact, it was through Gary's leadership and those at the time at the organization who founded National Minority Health Month in April as a pivotal, you know, month to bring awareness of the disparities facing communities of color. He really, you know, emphasized the need to build this organization to strengthen, you know, these efforts both nationally as well as locally using evidence-based and data-driven initiatives and programs to eliminate the disproportionate impact and burden and even premature death that individuals and communities of color face. And through that work, we've been building things such as disease indexes, really getting down to the zip code level of where disparities occur in our nation, even down to the congressional and state and even state legislative district areas. We have various programs and research efforts where we hope to really make an impact on the health and lives of individuals in these communities.
And you spoke recently on our webinar series about this, and you did show a heat map of the United States, and you were telling us that some of the darker colors represent where the sickle cell patients live, and other colors show where the major medical centers are, which is where a lot of clinical trials take place. Immediately shining a light on the fact that a lot of people who would benefit from clinical trials couldn't get to those trials as long as the trials are in places far from where they live. So that kind of research and those kinds of facts seem to me to be coming from the National Minority Equality Forum and others that raise awareness about that seem to be an important stage in transformation, that people need to be aware of that gap. Is that right? Is that the kind of focus you bring to this?
Yes, definitely. You know, the national health indices are across a number of different disease areas. Over the last several decades, Gary and his team has acquired about 5 billion patient records, really spanning across Medicaid and Medicare, really looking at where a number of different diseases are congregated, and also digging down into what types of policy efforts could be addressed to really care for individuals in those areas. In terms of sickle cell disease, I think it's really important to note that the history of the disease, you know, it is Sickle Cell Awareness Month. We're in the last few days of September. And, it, you know, sickle cell disease is one that impacts primarily the southeastern portion of the United States. And as a result, you can kind of see it congregated there still, even when you consider migration and other patterns. And so this level of detail that the Sickle Cell Disease Index, as well as the other indices that NMQF collaborates on, it organizes, it's really important to really bring attention to this so that both researchers, both clinicians, policymakers, the healthcare community at large will really understand where the communities are that they seek to serve.
And you also were involved in newborn screening in Africa for sickle cell disease. And that's one of the areas that's of primary focus for advocates right now in the rare disease community across all rare diseases when we talk about legislative advocacy, because we have increasing numbers of drugs being approved for rare and very devastating diseases, yet there's no newborn screening for a lot of them. And as that means people might be having progressing symptoms without even knowing they have the disease, even though they could have a newborn screening test, which would have detected it. And the reason the legislative advocacy is important that you're doing and National Minority Quality Forum does and the Congressional Black Caucus and the rare disease advocates is there's a real lack of awareness of just how bad our legal process is for getting a newborn screening test approved and how long that takes. It takes many years. So this is an area of damage to patients that occurs without actually having it be strictly a scientific problem we're trying to solve. It's a policy problem. So your background in public policy is enormously important for, I would say, transformation. What about sickle cell disease? Tell us what it is, first of all, and what are the challenges for patients at the patient level, and also what patient advocates are focusing on for them?
Thanks, Steve. So, you know, sickle cell disease is historically been characterized as the first molecular disease. And by that, I mean that when we started looking at the molecular basis of disease and etiology, it really was one of the very first that was documented. And it is an inherited lifelong blood disorder. In individuals that have the disease, it causes them to produce abnormal hemoglobin. We know hemoglobin is that oxygen-carrying molecule within our blood. And in individuals with sickle cell disease, these red blood cells become rigid and sickle-shaped. And these sickled cells, as we call them, they're called sickle. Interestingly, you mentioned Africa and the work we did there. In Africa, there was this garden tool called the sickle. And it's kind of shaped like a crescent moon. But these sickled cells have a shortened lifespan, and it also results in a constant shortage of the red blood cells or anemia. But sickle cell anemia, or SS, is only one type. There are various types of sickle cell disease. But when these sickled cells drive or follow through the blood vessels, they often get stuck in very small blood vessels, blocking their oxygen-rich blood cells from being, you know, able to travel through the body and provide oxygen where needed, especially in areas like the brain. So this leads to complication ranging in severity from, you know, severe pain to a syndrome we call acute chest syndrome. It can result in stroke, organ damage, and even premature death. In fact, the average lifespan of an individual living with sickle cell disease is in their late fourth decade of life.
And I've heard from other advocates that since sickle cell is not, I would say, well enough understood in the medical community, it isn't unusual to be in a hospital with an acute pain episode, but not to be believed that there really is that level of pain, as medical professionals are trying to lean away from giving powerful pain drugs and so forth. Is that the case?
This is a double-edged sword here when we talk about sickle cell disease and pain. Unfortunately, we're living not only in the times of COVID-19, but we're also living through an opioid epidemic. And while, you know, Congress was really pivotal in passing legislation to really curtail the usage of opioids, it also caused the challenge and inability of individuals who rightfully deserve opioids for their treatment such as individuals with sickle cell, but also cancer, to face a lot of challenges in accessing this known treatment. But it also brings about the issues of like implicit bias and even some, you know, racial discord in our nation, whereby individuals with this disease often aren't believed. They're considered drug seekers when they're not. They live lifelong with this painful disorder. So yes, they do come into the emergency room knowing what dosage of Dilaudid or other pain medications they need for their care. They're well known and versed, and they're just not treated the same as other individuals. There's been several studies looking at the bias and treatment of individuals with sickle cell disease, especially in the emergency room, but not just the emergency room, also throughout primary care and other areas of healthcare, where an individual presenting with a same pain level in another disease or condition is provided and triaged differently than individuals with sickle cell disease, even despite known guidelines for their care. They also face a number of challenges. Up until recently, there were not many known therapeutics, approved therapeutics for the treatment of sickle cell disease. In fact, the only one when I first started working in sickle cell disease was hydroxyurea. And the indication for hydroxyurea really was not one in which a lot of individuals were taking. This was a known chemotherapeutic that was found to increase fetal hemoglobin levels. And the great thing and interesting thing, which we didn't mention about fetal hemoglobin, is that when a baby is born with sickle cell disease, they don't start having all of these complications. It's later on through their development when the fetal hemoglobin shifts over to the adult hemoglobin, and in the individual with sickle cell disease, it turns into sickle hemoglobin. Hydroxyurea actually is able to boost the number of fetal hemoglobin in the blood and allows that individual to have an amelioration of some of their symptoms. So back to the story of where we are with therapeutics. You know, 4.5, almost 5 years ago when I first started working in sickle cell disease, we only had hydroxyurea. Now we have 4 FDA-approved drugs for sickle cell disease and about 40-plus in the pipeline. So it makes for a really exciting time to be working in this area.
That's really encouraging to hear. As bad as things can be with some of these issues that you've been talking about, it can get worse when there's no clinical trial, but these things are moving forward. And there still remains not only a problem of African Americans and other underserved minorities simply being included in healthcare, but also in clinical research, and with these added barriers you're talking about. Here's a question that a lot of people are asking, and I think this is one of the pivotal questions. Trust in a community is a big part of getting people engaged in their own health, letting the healthcare providers and the clinical trial researchers come close enough. Do we have enough physicians in underserved minority communities? I mean, you're certainly well educated, and you are very deeply experienced in these areas that can lead to transformation. What would you advise young people, particularly from underserved communities, about going into medicine and clinical research as a career?
Oh my gosh. I'm really passionate about this, you know, issue. I feel that, you know, there's been some studies talking about the need for additional minorities in healthcare, but additionally in research. There was a report earlier this year around, you know, babies with chronic diseases being cared for individuals of the same ethnic, racial and ethnic background versus those not. And the outcomes are a bit discouraging. And I don't think it's necessarily an issue totally of race. I think sometimes it's an issue of trust. And despite well intentions, sometimes because of historical abuses, that level of trust isn't always there. Additionally, I feel that, you know, we've made some progress in individuals of, you know, minority backgrounds into medicine, into health, into research. I myself was a product of the late Congressman Lewis Stokes' efforts to increase minority participation in the sciences. But programs like that are dying out, and I feel that there is need to revamp those. He actually, Congressman Stokes, had a program called AMP, and it really was advancing minority participation, and there's need for additional programs like that, especially in medicine. There was an old AAMC study, it's probably almost 7-8 years old now, probably, looking at African-American males in medicine. And we're actually seeing it reversed. We're not seeing the numbers we were in the late 90s and early 2000s. And where we are in this nation is, it's just a little saddening to see that as much progress as we've made, we're taking steps backwards. I feel that there's ways to diversify clinical trials. I feel there's ways to diversify clinical research and ways to diversify medicine. And all of it doesn't mean that you need to be at a historically Black college or university or be an African American or Hispanic American or Asian American or any other Indigenous American to serve in those communities. Get to know the communities you're in. Take some cultural competency courses. Go out and join, the organizations that serve these individuals and understand the needs that they face, the needs that they have, and the challenges that they face, because what you read in the media is not always what is boots on the ground individuals are telling you. And in terms of patient engagement, I know that that's of tremendous importance in clinical research right now. It's not a one-time activity. It is a marathon. You need to have a complete comprehensive plan, a means to engage the population at large. And, get to know that community. In sickle cell disease, we actually don't really use the word patient. We actually say individuals living with sickle cell disease, sickle cell warriors, or other terms that community, welcomes. But you have to not just show up at a national meeting. You can't just show up one time because you have an ask of them. Find out what their needs are, understand their challenges, and employ strategies to really overcome the barriers and challenges they face, and be a true friend and partner in this process.
Yes, you're talking about a sustained long-term commitment, and you're talking about really, it's a call to action to everybody. It doesn't have, like you were saying, you don't have to be from the community, but it's a call to action for those at universities to encourage students in certain directions, and at high schools and even middle schools to have a real comprehensive way of saying, you can do this too. This is for you, to invite people in and then give them the guidance, the mentoring, and the training.
Definitely. I think organizations like my former employer and others are really doing some efforts around minority recruitment and retention, finding out what are some of the barriers for even those clinicians who are going to med school and doing their fellowship training. What are some of the challenges that are presenting themselves to these individuals of these, diverse communities, and create strategies that will retain them? For example, in sickle cell disease, you would ask, are there enough providers? I would say no. If you talk about pediatric care, I think pediatrics in sickle cell disease is fortunate to have a number of well-established pediatric academic medical centers. But when an individual transitions from pediatric to adult care, roughly in their 20s, many of them end up in emergency room settings, which is not optimal for a chronic condition because there's not enough adult hematologists. And the problem with hematology currently is that oftentimes the training programs for a condition like sickle cell disease, which we call benign hematology, or I'd like to just say non-malignant because there's nothing benign about this disease, is that there's only a handful of programs across the U.S. that really allow for this level of training. And so minority individuals who really want to focus on areas of hematology that affect their community really don't have the opportunity to get that training easily. They end up really going into malignant hematology and leaving individuals, with sickle cell disease to really have to fight to try to find adequate care.
you've really painted a picture of a huge need in our society, not only in sickle cell disease, but certainly in that community of sickle cell warriors. And I think you've articulated a call to action to for everybody to start bringing more people into the fold, encouraging young people to become educated in this area and participate. Sorry that we're out of time, Tasha. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much, Steve. If I could do one last plug for those sure. researchers out there wanting to know a little bit more about sickle cell disease, Gary, myself, and Dr. Smith-Whitley published a paper last year on sickle cell disease disparities. So, and that was in Public Health Reports. So I really advise everyone to look at that publication to get an understanding of the disparities in sickle cell disease.
And what is the URL for the National Minority Quality Forum?
Great question. So www.nmqf.org.
Thank you very much. It was nice speaking with you today, Tasha.
Thank you, Steve.
We've been speaking today with Tasha Lee, the Vice President of Social and Clinical Research and Development at the National Minority Quality Forum. This is Steve Smith of WCG Patient Radio. Special thanks to executive producer Lauren Osmore, production staff Isabel Andresen, Roxana Guilford-Blake, technical director David Fogel, and head of studio Amy Hutnick. Goodbye, everybody.